Right, we have a lot to do today, and so I want to get right to it. The first thing is an announcement about the homework, and I'll make this now. But those of you who are going to straggle in late, be sure to tell them. There's an equation about 2/3 of the way down the front page of the homework, which is the Lindblad equation, about which more in due course today, for the harmonic oscillator subject to spontaneous decay. And that equation has a misprint in the last bit. And so the last bit should actually look like this. And after the lecture today, you'll see, of course, exactly why it has to be exactly like this. But there's a bit of a misprint. You should correct it. It actually doesn't change some of the answers. Yeah. Oh, you're right. I've written it wrong again. Now you see where this came from. It's sheer carelessness on my part. Luckily, you're all here to help me catch up. That has to be a negative sign there. Okay, very good. I appreciate it. All right, so this is the real equation from the homework. Okay, and of course, you'll actually be able to write this down on your own after today's lecture. We were talking about the evolution of an open system, that is to say, a system that interacted with its environment. The system started out in some state which we might describe as a density operator, and it's interacting with an environment. If I wanted to assign a density operator to the environment, I'd assign this state. The environment is then a pure state, and that state is fixed in the sense that it's just part of the conditions under which my system is evolving. I'm not going to think about how things change if this varies. And there's an interaction between them that's a unitary interaction. And I also chose a particular basis of states for the environment in order to do my partial trace operation. And this basis allowed me to define an operator that actually acts in the Hilbert space of Q. The operator acting on psi is simply this partial inner product. I take psi with zero, the product state. I allow the unitary interaction to act, and then I take the partial inner product of the resulting QE vector with the Q state K. That gives me a Q vector that depends in a linear way on psi, and so this defines this operator A. And then I said I was able to show that the state of system Q, of the open system interacting with the environment, the state of that system evolved over this period of time to a state, and I designated this map on density operators from the initial density operator to the final density operator by a script E. This map is simply the sum over K, AK, rho, AK dagger. These AKs are called Krauss operators, and this is an operator sum representation or Krauss representation of this map on density operators, and it amounts to a super operator, a linear map on operators. It takes an operator, gives me another operator in a linear way. Okay, that was last time, and we looked at some examples of this, and this could describe unitary evolution was a special case of it with only a single Krauss operator. And so on. And there was one more thing that we found about these operators, and that is that the sum over K of AK dagger AK was the identity. That was a consequence of the fact that my final state is normalized, always. Okay, so now I want to think about a situation in which I have not just time evolution over one time interval, but multiple time intervals. So let's suppose I have some initial time t0, and it evolves to t1 and on to t2. Okay, three times in a row. And at t0, we have the conditions of this satisfied, namely that Q and E are unentangled to begin with. There's no correlations between them. Okay, so the interaction, QE interaction, is unitary throughout. That is to say, there's just some kind of unitary interaction involving the environment and the system. And that just goes through the entire time interval. Okay, so let's think about the kinds of maps we could define using this. We can describe the open system dynamics going from time 0 to time 1 by something we might call E10. That's going from T0 to T1. We can use this same business to define this map. I can tell you how an initial state, a state of Q at T0, turns into a new density operator for Q at T1. And I can also do the same thing going from T0 to T2. The only difference would be this unitary operator would be the unitary time evolution from T0 all the way to T2. But how about this guy? How about E21, that is to say, going from T1 to T2. Does such a thing exist? Can I define a map that tells me how Q density operators at T1 turn into density operators at T2? Can I use this scheme to do that? Uh-huh. What do you think?
Yes.
What? Any other votes? Who says yes? Who says no? All right. The answer is no. In general, you can't. And let me tell you why. And the reason is this is all based on the fact that Q is initially unentangled with the environment. So that once I tell you the Q state, I've told you everything you need to know, because the environment starts out in a fixed state. But at this stage, at time equal to T1, that's not true. That's true at T0, but it's not true here. So there might be two completely different entangled states of Q and E at T1, which look the same in Q, have the same Q density operator. So the Q density operator doesn't tell you exactly about everything about the entanglement between Q and E. And so they might lead to quite different states here. So there is no, in general, no such map. Yeah?
There is no linear map, or there is no map?
There is no map. The two situations that have the same Q density operator here might lead to different Q density operators there. Therefore, no map. Okay? Therefore, no map. So the point is that that in order to do this, we've made this initial assumption. We've made this assumption that the environment and the system start out uncorrelated, unentangled. That assumption is not holding at T1 necessarily. So QE might be entangled, generally is, at T2. So we don't have something simple like the time evolution over the whole interval is simply the composition of a couple of maps. The first map going from 0 to 1 and the second one going from 1 to 2. We don't have that. Which is really too bad. That in general, we don't have that. Well, yeah.
Isn't the problem that they might be entangled at T1?
I'm sorry, what?
Isn't the problem that the state might be entangled at T1?
Yes, that's the problem. Therefore, well, there is no such map.
It's T2.
Like that. What did I say? T1, right. Of course, T1. That's the problem. It also is likely entangled at T2, but that's no problem. We're not going to, in our diagram, we don't want to go further. Okay, this is a problem. But I want to do it anyway. Okay? And to do this, I'm going to have to make an idealization or an approximation. I'm going to talk about what's called a Markov process. A Markov process. A Markov process. And you've all sort of heard of Markov processes. What's a Markov process? It's kind of a sequential process. Okay? It's a sequential process. So you might imagine that this process takes place over a sequence of time steps from one to the next. Okay? And the key thing about a Markov process, and generally we talk about Markov processes as being probabilistic, but we're going to generalize that, of course, to quantum Markov processes. A Markov process is a process in which the state, the key idea is that the state, whatever that means, at t n plus 1 depends only on the state at tn. So, the idea of a Markov process is that the answer to this question is actually yes. Okay? The answer to this question is actually yes. That yes, there is a map that tells me how the state at this guy goes to the state at this guy. I only need to know this in order to do this. This process has no memory. What the state was here only affects the state at the end in as much as it determines this state. If you know this state, you know everything you need to know to go here. That's not true for evolution of the open system Q in general, but this is a kind of a Markov process is a process that would have that. Now the evolution of the open system Q, as I said, is not, oh yeah, go ahead. Oh, well, I imagine this proceeding in a series of time steps. These might be very close time, close together. I might come up with an idea of a continuous Markov process as a limiting case. And as you'll see, we'll do something kind of like that. Okay, so the evolution of the open system Q is not a Markov process, really, but we can often model it or approximate it as a Markov process. We're going to consider what we might call the Markov approximation. The Markov approximation. Well, why is the Markov assumption no good? The reason is that the environment is entangled with the system at this intermediate time. That's the problem, right? So that when the system continues on, that entanglement, the fact that it's actually entangled with the environment, might have future consequences for the evolution of the system. The entanglement might sort of echo back and have a consequence. But suppose I had my system Q, okay, and it's interacting with my environment, which I'm going to imagine to be much bigger. So I got Q here, and I got the environment. And let's think about we've got internal dynamics of Q. I'll write that this way. Internal dynamics of Q and the interaction between Q and E. And let's imagine that these parts of the dynamics are pretty slow. Okay, this doesn't happen very fast. The internal dynamics of Q and the interaction, these guys are slow. Slow dynamics here. But then E has internal dynamics of its own. Different parts of the environment are interacting with each other. And let's suppose that the environment's pretty big, so the energies associated with that environment are very large. Let's imagine that this dynamics, I'm not sure what these arrows mean, but maybe that's they represent phase space trajectories or something. Let's imagine that the dynamics of E, this is fast internal dynamics, and also it's a kind of dynamics that we might describe as mixing. In other words, the state of E gets thoroughly scrambled very rapidly. The state of the environment gets thoroughly scrambled very rapidly. then we might hope that at any particular time, the entanglement between Q and E is almost impossible to see. It's spread out among a bunch of remote degrees of freedom of E. Okay? The entanglement that Q got with some near part of E gets rapidly spread out and mixed up into the environment, and you basically don't see it. It basically has no effect. Okay? So at any given time, Q doesn't really see the effects of its entanglement with the environment. You might hope that, at least in some regime where this was fast and complicated and this was fairly slow and simple, that in some regime like that, then this Markov approximation would hold pretty good. Because although Q and E might become entangled technically, from a practical point of view, that entanglement has almost no consequence because it's all very complicatedly squished up in complicated little degrees of freedom of the environment. Okay? For example, you got an atom. It interacts with the electromagnetic field. Okay? A little while later, it's in some superposition, entangled superposition between the atoms being excited and no photon existing in the environment, and the atom being in the ground state, and a photon exists in the environment. Atom becomes entangled with the electromagnetic field. But the dynamics of the electromagnetic field may be that very rapidly, I'm speaking very heuristically here, very rapidly, the photon gets away, and the local environment is essentially the vacuum again. Okay? That entanglement is a short-term kind of thing. And so in the long run, over longer time scales, it will behave as if the local environment is not entangled with the atom. And so in that case, the Markov approximation might be a good way to see how the atom behaves. Yeah?
So I don't understand why it's a fair assumption to say the environment is developing fast. Huh.
You understand why, or you don't?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, what determines a couple of things. One is that let me just mention one thing. What determines the speed of some quantum dynamics of a system? The energy. The environment's a really big system. So the frequencies in the environment for different environment states will all be large, and they might be quite different. The differences between them might be large. Compared to various energies associated with Q, and so that might lead to some fairly fast evolution. And also, if you think about this, not as that so much as an assumption about the environment, as an assumption about some relationship between these guys, then what I'm saying is that might be true, and we're going to see what the consequences are if it is true, but there might be plenty of cases where it's not. So what we're going to do now is not fundamental in the same way, but it's really useful in a lot of practical situations. And the example of the atom decaying in the vacuum, how that a Markov approximation might be good for that, suggests that this makes heuristic sense in that case. Because the electromagnetic field has lots and lots and lots and lots of degrees of freedom, which is why the photon can propagate to a very distant part of the universe. And so the entanglement can kind of disappear into those distant degrees of freedom that aren't directly interacting with Q. And it can happen fast. Okay. All right. So what about this? What do we get? Well, I'm going to make this Markov approximation, and I'm going to see what the consequences are, or at least one consequence. And basically, it just means that in any sort of chain of times, I'm going to be able to consider the time evolution to be a series of independent stages, each represented by a map. So let's imagine a small time interval. Well, length delta t. Now, I've written a delta t because I want to remind myself, at least for a little bit, that delta t is small compared to dynamics of Q, but short compared to dynamics of E. Okay? So in a given time interval, delta Q, lots of stuff happens here. The states get scrambled around quite a bit, but not much happens over here. Okay? So this is for Q, delta T is short. But for E, delta T is long. So rather than writing it as an infinitesimal at this stage, I want to just remind you that what kind of time scale we're looking at. I'm going to imagine, therefore, that the quantum state evolves from rho to rho plus a little bit, a small change. That small change is proportional to the length of the time interval. In other words, I'm going to resolutely ignore things of order delta t squared and higher when I consider the evolution of the Q state. Okay? Now, during that evolution, of course, rho plus delta rho is equal to sum over k of some a sub k's rho a sub k dagger. We're assuming that this is true, because we're making this Markov approximation, that at any given time interval, I'm going to be able to make this assumption, the assumption that leads to this expression. That's it. The assumption that leads to this expression. All right. But this is nearly rho. This is nearly rho. And also we know that the exact AKs that we use to represent this evolution are a little bit arbitrary. I can mess around with them by picking a different basis for my environment. So the idea is that I can fiddle around with the A's to the point where one of the A's is close to the identity, and the other A's are small. Okay, so one A is close to the identity. So let's say A zero is close to the identity, and the other AKs are small. For K equal to one, to whatever. Whatever my number is, so that's the idea here. Okay, so let me write these out. I'm going to include the terms that I'm going to need to include, so that I only consider the first order in time terms here. Well, let's think about this. If A naught is close to the identity, if I have something close to the identity, rho, something close to the identity. That's going to be close to rho, right? But there's going to be some terms that are first order in the difference between this and the identity. The first order terms will arise. And so I'm going to say that A0 is actually equal to the identity plus some operator that's proportional to delta t, because those are because the differences I'm considering are differences of order delta t. Now, what am I going to put here? Well, this could be any old operator at all. I don't know what it is. So I'm going to break that operator up into its Hermitian and anti-Hermitian parts. Okay? So I'm going to call the Hermitian part L sub 0, and the anti-Hermitian part I'm going to call minus I times h, and this is an operator h. Okay? Minus I times h. And it just turns out that if I write it this way, then This is a good thing to do, okay? But it's some operator times delta t, and so L naught and h are Hermitian. Okay. Now, what about the other terms? Well, the other terms and all the other terms are going to have like a one rho, a one dagger, and if that's proportional to delta t, then the other ak terms have to be some operators times the square root of delta t. Sum operators times the square root of delta t. Okay? So that I get terms proportional to delta t from those. So sort of on fairly general grounds, I think that the lowest order contributions will be from expressions like this. All right, so let's work out what it is. Well, it's not hard to to work it out. What this tells me is that rho plus delta rho is equal to, well, let's see, there's going to be a 1 plus L naught minus IH rho, sorry, there's a delta t. Let's not forget delta t rho 1 plus L naught plus IH delta t. That's the first term of this sum. And the only thing that the dagger did was it turned that minus I to a plus I. And then there's going to be plus sum over k LK rho LK dagger times delta t. Two factors of the square root of delta t gives me a delta t. Okay? Now from this I can see that there's going to be a term which is just rho. That's identity times rho times the identity. And then there are going to be some terms involving delta t. And then there's going to be some terms involving delta t squared, which I will ignore. Okay? And so I can just write that delta rho is equal to something times delta t. And what is that something? Well, there's an L naught rho L naught. No, sorry, L naught times rho, excuse me, because that's L naught times rho times the identity. And there's another term, which is rho times L naught. It's the identity rho L naught. And then in the terms involving H, there's a plus, there's an H rho, so I'll write it this way. I'll write it as plus 1 over I, which is minus I, okay? Plus 1 over I times, there's an H rho, and then there's a rho H term, but that comes in with the opposite sign, so I'm going to have H rho minus rho H. And then plus the sum over k lk rho lk dagger, all of that times delta t. So that's how the state's going to, that's the tiny change in the state over a tiny time interval under the Markov assumption, in the Markov approximation, which may or may not be valid. So now I can say, well, if this is a short enough time interval, I can think of this as giving me a differential equation, an equation of motion for rho. And the equation of motion looks like this, that the derivative of rho with respect to time, and this is the rate of change of rho over time intervals that are actually long enough to be long compared to the environment's dynamical time interval. So this is a little bit tricky. The environment's so fast that it mixes itself up instantaneously in this idealization. And what'll that be? Well, it'll be the things in parentheses here. Let's write it down. There's going to be an anti-commutator of L naught with rho. Okay, that's the anti-commutator there. There's going to be a plus 1 over I times a commutator of H with rho. And there's going to be a sum over K of LK rho LK dagger. Okay? So that's a differential equation that governs the time evolution of the state in the Markov approximation. Now, I recognize certain things about this. Right? I recognize certain things about this. For example, if none of the L's, if the L0 and the LK operators were somehow zero, I would just have this. And that looks like the Schrodinger equation for a density operator, right? So I'm going to recognize this guy, and that tells me to define the system Hamiltonian to be just H bar times H. And then this will be 1 over IH bar times the commutator of the Hamiltonian with rho. That's good. And by the way, this Hamiltonian, in this picture right here, this Hamiltonian may involve both internal dynamics of Q and shifts to the internal dynamics of Q produced by interactions with E. So this is not just this Hamiltonian is not necessarily the Hamiltonian that for Q that appears in the Schrodinger equation for the entire system. Okay, there's maybe some corrections. Yeah.
You didn't say anything about the commutator getting to be and H. I was expecting to see a mixed term there for L not rho and H.
Oh, yeah, so I could add things of order delta t squared, because those guys would involve two factors of delta t, and I've resolved to ignore those things, because that delta t is to some extent small. That's correct. That's correct. That would be true, but because I'm ignoring terms of this order, I didn't write them down. Yeah?
The H that we defined, could it be seen as the Hamiltonian of Q plus the interaction with E?
It's not so simple, because the interaction of E also affects these guys. I don't know any principled way to separate those effects except to see how they appear in this equation. Okay. Other questions? All right. There's one more thing that I want to. Let me write down the equation that I've got so far. Okay. So far, we're not quite done with it. So far, we said that the derivative of rho with respect to time is equal to, let's see, let's write the Hamiltonian bit first, 1 over I h bar commutator of h with rho, that's very nice, plus the anti-commutator of L naught with rho, plus the sum over k of Lk rho Lk dagger. Now, there's something that I want to note. And that something that I want to note is that the trace of the derivative of rho had better be zero, because the trace of rho is a constant. The trace of rho is a constant. Rho doesn't change its trace. So zero has got to equal to the trace of the derivative of rho with respect to time. The derivative of the trace is the trace of the derivative. It's a nice linear operator, and all the sums and everything go inside it. So this had better be zero. So let's look at the trace of these guys. Well, what do I get when I take the trace of a commutator? I get zero, right? Because the trace of AB is the same as trace of BA. So this guy gives me zero. Oh, what about an anti-commutator? The trace of AB plus BA. Well, that's just twice the trace of AB, right? So this gives me 2 times the trace of rho L naught. Okay? And this gives me, 0 plus that. And this gives me, it's the sum over k of the trace of Lk rho Lk dagger, but of course I can cyclically produce that trace and call it Lk dagger Lk. I'll put the rho out front actually. Rho Lk dagger Lk. I can cyclically permute this trace here. And this has to add up to zero, and from that I find that the trace of rho times L naught has to be equal to minus 1/2 the sum over k, or in fact I could take the k that inside, the trace of rho times the sum over k Lk dagger Lk. That has to be true. Well, suppose rho is equal to the rho for some pure state. That's possible. Well, then this would mean that this inner product for L naught has to equal minus one half, let's do it even better, has to equal to the inner product of psi with the operator minus one half, sum over k, lk dagger lk. That has to be true. Yeah?
Can we use the sum of the lk dagger lk to use the identity?
No, because the sum of the ak dagger lks gives you the identity. But the aks, first of all, were multiplied by, these guys were the square root of delta p times that. Secondly, there was an additional ak, which was the zero one, that included contributions from this guy. In fact, what we're doing is we're finding the consequences of that fact for the LK operators. It's exactly what we're doing. Okay? So you could actually go back and take these AK operators and insist that the traits of L dagger, of A dagger A be equal to the identity, and get the same thing that I'm about to say now. Which is, if this is true for any psi, according to the very first homework problem I gave you for the tutorial, these operators must be the same. Wasn't it amazing how often I use that trick? Okay? It should be in your back pocket whenever you need an operator trick. That's one of the good ones. Okay. So this means that L naught has to be equal to minus one half the sum over k of LK dagger LK. L naught is not an independent operator. It has to satisfy this to preserve normalization. It must satisfy this to preserve normalization. So that means I can rewrite this L0, as minus one half times the sum of the LK dagger LKs. And I can combine these sums, and I can arrive at the equation that was my destination. The Lindblad equation. Goran Lindblad derived this almost 30 years ago now. And it's a very nice general way of looking at things. Okay, my equation is the derivative of rho with respect to time is equal to 1 over I h bar times the Hamiltonian commutator plus the sum over k of lk rho lk dagger, and I'm going to actually erase bits of this so that I have plenty of room for this wonderful equation, minus 1 half the Andy commutator of LK dagger LK with rho. There it is. The Lindblad equation. The Lindblad equation. Yeah?
Did we say that LK is emission?
No. We don't know anything about LK. Just as we didn't know anything about these guys. These operators didn't have to be Hermitian or anything. Some of them could be unitary. We saw all kinds of examples. And in the same way, we don't know anything about the LK operators. Well, they have a name. The LK operators are, unsurprisingly, Lindblad operators. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, and that's what you get. There was another question that was out here. Yeah.
So, where did the LKs come from?
The LKs came in the first place. The LKs came in the first place from the idea that AK, well, A's the one of these guys was close to the identity. It was 1 plus L0 minus IH times delta T. It was something close to the identity, or the difference proportional to delta T. And the AKs for other values of K, and this sum now includes only the other values of K, was some operator times the square root of delta t. These guys were related to the AKs in this way. Okay, that's where they came from.
And we know the domain of AKs.
Well, the domain of AKs.
Yeah, domain of the operator. So we can say use that thing that those really are the same.
Oh, okay. Um, I have assumed basically all the nice facts about operators that would be true in a finite dimensional space. And I'm only going to really be using this in a finite dimensional or a separable dimensional Hilbert space, something really small, something not very big. In the homework problem, you actually use it for the harmonic oscillator. But the way we do this is we're going to specify what these operators are. We're not going to derive them from fundamental principles. Let me say some words about that. Okay, all right. This is a great equation. This is a really nice equation. It's an equation of motion for rho. It plays kind of the role for open system dynamics that the Schrodinger equation would play for isolated system dynamics, right? Because it tells you at any given time how the state is changing right then. However, it's not fundamental. Its validity depends on the Markov approximation, first of all. And secondly, it's extremely tricky. To answer your question, it's extremely tricky. It's not impossible. It's very tricky to actually derive these operators from first principles, knowing the Hamiltonian of the joint system QE. That's actually really hard. And the reason it's really hard, very, very tricky, very delicate, is because in the course of that derivation, you have to establish the Markov approximation in some suitable approximation. That will be a laborious argument. And then the part that survives the Markov approximation will be these. So I'm not going to be able to give you as neat a derivation of those as I can give you for these operators. Not going to be able to. However, this sort of not fundamental equation that is true only in a particular approximation and is very difficult to derive the terms of from first principles, though not impossible, it's very laborious, nevertheless is very handy in many situations. It's very useful. We can often introduce these LKs on physical grounds. We say there's a phenomenon in the system we want to model, so we introduce the LKs to model that particular process. Yeah?
Is H the Hamiltonian of just the subsystem Q?
If you started out with a Hamiltonian for Q, and a Hamiltonian for E, and an interaction Hamiltonian between them, actually, there's no way to insist on that decomposition. I could break off a little bit of the Hamiltonian of Q and put it into the Hamiltonian for the interaction. It would still be an interaction Hamiltonian for Q and E. That would be perfectly okay, right? And for that reason and for others, if I wrote down the Hamiltonian for the big system Q plus the environment, I might not be able to pick out from that what this is. The other thing is that the environment, one of the things that the environment might do is it might change the energies of the systems or something like this. So for example, in NMR systems, the nuclei are surrounded by an electronic environment. One of the things the electronic environment does is it changes the energy levels of the nuclei in the magnetic field by something called the chemical shift. And that's a kind of an alteration of the Hamiltonian of the nuclei, but it's produced by an interaction with the environment. It's produced by the electrons. So this is a Hamiltonian for the system. It's the part of the Lindblad equation that looks like the time evolution of an informationally isolated system. And if these terms were zero, that's exactly what would happen. This would be unitary time evolution. Okay? Unitary time evolution is a Lindblad equation with these terms all zero and this guy being the Hamiltonian. It plays the role of the Hamiltonian, but I can't just say, oh yeah, well let's just write down what the internal Hamiltonian of Q is, and that's what you got here. It's a little bit more complicated, in fact.
So I can't just say that the interaction lives
in the hours. In as much as you can No, you can't say that. The interaction lives in the L's, certainly. Without an interaction, there would be no L's. But the interaction might also make changes in H. That's also a possible effect of the interaction. Yeah?
In the previous homework question, I think it was, when we did this thing with two operators inside the any random state doing the same thing, and we used like a kind of roughly equal sign and said it was called equivalent or something.
I'm sorry.
You said when that fact is the case, you didn't say that they're equal. You said you used sort of like an equal.
Oh, well, if these things are equal for all psi,
right,
then the operators are equal.
Okay.
We proved that.
Well, yeah, it just had a different symbol in it, and it didn't specify what it meant.
In the homework, I was talking about an equivalence of two functionals, okay, and that's a more subtle business than the equality of two operators. Equivalence of functionals in these functional inner products corresponds to equality of operators in the Hilbert space picture, okay. But I use a different symbol because the functionals aren't exactly equal. They simply always give the same inner products in this way, and that's a more subtle business. Okay, yeah, right you are. Other questions? Okay, so you can now go off and conquer the world with the Lindblad equation. Let me give you just a really quick example, chosen not because it's the chosen merely because it's the easiest example I can think of. But I wanted to show you that you can describe an interesting process with the Lindblad equation. And the process is the process of qubit decoherence. Now, what I want to do is I want to write the state of my qubit as, of course, 1/2 times the identity plus a block vector, which also might depend on time, times the Pauli vector, not an end of the Pauli vector, right? So this depends on time, and I want to find out how this depends on time. And so I'm going to assume that there's no internal Hamiltonian, and there's only one Lindblad operator. One Lindblad operator, and it's equal to something which I'll call lambda to the 1/2 times the z operator. And so let me tell you a few things about this to make this palatable. The first thing is, what are the units of the Lindblad operators? What's the unit of a Lindblad operator? What units? What? It's the square root of energy, right. It's 1 over square root of time, right? So the Lindblad operators go as time to the minus 1/2. And so here, I multiply it by something that's going to have units of inverse time, to the 1/2. That's the first thing. Second thing is, what does this do? What does z do? What does the operator z do? Well, z, of course, is 0 minus the projection on the 0 minus the projection on the 1. What this would do, what z does, is if I feed it a superposition of 0 and 1, a 0 plus b 1, then the z operator will give me a 0 minus b 1. So what this does, what the z operator does, is it flips the phase, the relative phase of 1 with respect to 0. Okay? It doesn't change the magnitude of these superpositions, but it changes their relative phase. And so what we might imagine this Lindblad operator representing is that the environment has the effect of every so often randomly flipping the phase of 1 with respect to 0. So this is a random phase flip. You can think of this as representing a random phase flip. And lambda represents kind of how often that happens, how rapidly that happens, how fast that process is. For a big lambda, this happens really quickly. Phases are flipping all the time. But for a small lambda, it's very rare. Yeah?
Is there any good justification as to why the environment should act like that?
No. I'm suggesting that if my environment acts like this, then I can describe the situation with a Lindblad equation. Okay? Remember, I'm being very pragmatic here. Okay? I have an equation such that if the Markov approximation holds, okay, then I'll be able to use this equation. But I'm not going to do the much harder job. Sorry, it's cowardice. Sorry, I'm not going to do the much harder job of taking some particular model of the environment, showing that the Markov approximation is a good one, and doing that. Another way of doing this, though, is you can imagine that the environment is effectively measuring, in a weak way, whether you're in the plus z or the minus z eigenstates. Okay? It's essentially measuring your z component in a weak way all the time. And that measurement scrambles the relative phases. It destroys the relative phases of the superposition. The measurement takes the superposition and turns it into a mixture. And so if you wanted to think of an environment that sort of is continually, in a weak way, monitoring the z component of the spin, then this effect might be described by this. That's a somewhat less hand-wavy example. Yeah?
Could you explain again why proportional to z?
Because I'm making it up. No, I'm coming up with an example that is calculationally easy, okay? And what I'm trying to explain is what this example represents. I'm not trying to justify this as from first principles as something that's really happening. I'm saying, suppose you had this. Suppose in the Lindblad equation, which is the form of the Markov continuous Markov process for a quantum mechanical system, suppose the Lindblad equation was such that there wasn't any zero. I mean, you didn't ask me to justify that h is equal to zero either. I mean, that's just as arbitrary, right? And I only had one Lindblad operator because I'm scared of the sum. It's just too many things, okay? All right? I want to write down something that's totally simple that I can solve really easily for you. And my justification for this is the easiest one I can think of because the Pauli operators are nice. I know all the properties of Pauli operators, okay? So I wrote down something like this. And now I'm trying to physically interpret it. So, for example, another example I thought of talking about is the idea of a qubit that undergoes a decay process, that zero stays zero, but randomly, one decays to zero. And that might be represented by a Lindblad operator that was proportional to the operator 0, 1, the outer product 0, 1, because this is an operator that, when it sees a 1, it turns it into a 0. Okay? And I'd pick this to describe this situation on purely pragmatic grounds. The Lindblad operators are going to kind of be representing various processes that the environment might be imposing on the system. Yeah?
So I need to respond to Callum's question that the LK zone have all the interaction in.
But well, I also said that, okay, so let me, interaction with the environment has two things that go on with it. Remember, we talked at the very beginning, the first 5 minutes of the first lecture, we talked about the conditions under which unitary dynamics takes place. And we said it's not quite that the system is isolated. The system can be affected by outside things, like outside fields and so on. The fact is that the system is informationally isolated. That's the requirement for the evolution to be unitary. Okay, so I want to make this point because the your prefatory remark to your question I wanted to squash, but then I wanted to hear the question. Okay, so the prefatory remark. So the environment's actually possibly doing two things. One of them is simply shifting the internal Hamiltonian of the system, a process that doesn't read any information out of the system, and another process in which the environment may be sort of reading information out. There may be information leaking out of the system into the environment. The system may no longer be informationally isolated. This is the first kind where the environment, the interaction with the environment, may be shifting the internal dynamics without reading any information out. This is the part in which information may be leaking into the environment. Okay, so your question. So this has, this is part of the interaction, but the interaction may also be included there. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. So I was going to ask this: the sum of over K, is we using one length ladder operator here? Is it just like with how many ways it can lose information that you're interacting with?
Yeah. I want to regard this as a kind of a modeling tool. A modeling tool for allowing us to talk about quantum systems that are evolving in a non-unitary way, but still a reasonable way, a physically reasonable way. Because of their interaction with the environment. So I'm somewhat resisting all the attempts to nail down exactly what these things exactly mean. Except they do correspond to the environment, if you will, gaining some information about the system. And here it may be just gaining one kind of one piece of information, something about the z component of spin. Yeah.
And when you say weak measurement, is that in the sense of weak measurement due to the quantum foundation?
I was trying to be a little bit fuzzier in my use of the word weak. However, I think the answer is probably yes, exactly. But what I simply mean is something that's not a absolutely complete measurement that's finished right away. It's something that is kind of in that direction, but is a long process that occurs over time, and it's not really coming to completion. That's what I mean by a weak measurement. Okay, so if this is the case. If this is the case, then the Lindblad equation is really easy because, of course, z dagger is the same as z, and z times itself is the identity, right? So this tells us that the derivative of rho with respect to t is equal to lambda times z rho z minus rho. That's it. That's the Lindblad equation. That's about as simple as you could hope for. Okay. Now, when I expand my state as a sum of the Pauli operators, then in this I'm going to have various kinds of sums. I'm going to have sums where I have zxz minus x and zyz minus y and zzz minus z. So I'm going to have things like that. So zxz minus x. What is that? Well, what is zxz? This is actually kind of a neat fact. It turns out that's equal to minus x. If you take any Pauli operator and you do any other Pauli operator and you do Pauli, other Pauli, Pauli, you get minus other Pauli. Yeah, okay, so this is actually minus 2x. And the same thing's true for y, zyz. Minus y turns out to be minus 2 times y. What about zzz minus z? What do I get for that? I get 0 because zzz is just z. And so z minus z is 0. And so that gives me some differential equations. When I put that in, that gives me differential equations for the components of the block vector. It tells me that the derivative with respect to time of ax is equal to minus 2 times lambda, don't forget lambda, times ax. And ay dot is equal to minus 2 times lambda times ay. And az dot is equal to 0. That tells me everything I need to know about how the state evolves in the system. In fact, what it tells me is that ax goes as e to the minus 2 lambda t. Ax decays exponentially. And ay decays exponentially. Whatever it started out being that decays away exponentially with a time constant, one over two lambda, which conveniently has units of time. And AZ, what happens to AZ? It's constant. Okay? So I now know how the block vector evolves. I got a block vector, what happens to it? It runs toward the z-axis. The x and y components decay away exponentially, but the z component stays constant. So if I were to look at that, here's the z-axis, and so up here is state 0, and down here is state 1. What happens is the whole block sphere, this evolution is described by taking the whole block sphere and compressing it toward the z-axis. The block sphere turns into the block football, and then the block cigar, and then the block needle. Okay? All right? So this is what it looks like at a later time. It goes toward the z-axis. The z-axis is made up of the mixtures of 0, 0, and 1, 1. The mixtures of 0, 0, and 1, 1. And so what happens is a superposition evolves toward a mixture of 0, 0, and 1, 1. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is to describe what happens to the density matrix. So in the 0, 1 basis, the populations, the diagonal elements, those guys are constant. The populations are constant. The diagonal elements of the density matrix are constant. But the coherences, which tell you the difference between a superposition and a mixture, the coherences go to zero, go toward zero, exponentially. And so the process that's modeled by this Lindblad operator, and I'm not making any fundamental assumptions here, but the process that would be modeled by this Lindblad operator would be a process in which the coherences in the density operator are exponentially suppressed. Now, there are many examples of serious models of interaction with the environment in which coherences are suppressed in various ways. And those guys, those models can be viewed as deriving a Lindblad equation for those systems. Okay. That's why I said this was decoherence, because in the standard basis, the net effect of this model is to suppress the coherences. In your homework, you will be examining the Lindblad equation for an oscillator system. And in that oscillator system, you're also going to have an internal Hamiltonian, okay? But you'll also have, which is the oscillator Hamiltonian, but you'll also, I'll also say that Hamiltonian may be able to spontaneously decay. That is to say, not the Hamiltonian, the system, the oscillator. So if it's in a high energy state, then it might decay over time. So we need an operator that will lower you from a high energy high energy level to a lower energy level. And the obvious operator to choose would be the harmonic oscillator lowering operator. So there, your Lindblad operator is lambda to the 1/2 times the lowering operator A. You've got one Lindblad operator. It's the sort of simplest Lindblad equation you could imagine for the harmonic oscillator. You've got the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian here and a single Lindblad operator here. And that represents the decay of the energy. And you're going to find out all kinds of great things. In particular, you're going to find out that this is the damped quantum harmonic oscillator. We've done the quantum harmonic oscillator, right? We probably haven't done the damped quantum harmonic oscillator. But this allows you to do it. You get exactly, you'll be able to show that the expectation value of position, for example, follows the equations of motion for the damped harmonic oscillator. All right? So the Lindblad equation enables you to give a kind of a quantum mechanical description for systems involving dissipative processes like friction. Okay? You can model dissipative processes like friction with a Lindblad equation. The Lindblad equation says it's an interaction with the environment in which the Markov approximation is good. Questions? Yeah?
For this qubit decoherence system, so how do you have any examples of this in the real world? Like, how big would lambda be?
There's good examples of in the real world of things that are a little bit more complicated. So let's imagine a spin in an NMR system. Okay, a nuclear spin in a proton in a strong magnetic field inside a molecule. It has a Hamiltonian perhaps where it's processing around and everything. But then what you find is that there is a relaxation. If you flip the spin on its side, okay. So instead of being a spin in the z direction, it's a spin in the x direction. It processes around like crazy, generates some radio waves, and that decays away. And that what's called transverse relaxation in an NMR system corresponds to decoherence in the z basis. And that transverse relaxation can be modeled pretty much exactly by a Lindblad equation like this. There's something else going on. You can also get flipping of the phase because of what's called longitudinal relaxation. But the transverse relaxation is pretty much exactly like this. And the time constant for that can be as long as even a few seconds. It's amazingly long in many NMR systems.
So when the coherence goes to zero, your system kind of becomes classical. Is that right?
No. However, it becomes classical.
The
density operator becomes diagonal in this basis.
Yes. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if that's your definition of the system becoming classical, yeah, that's right. Becomes classical. On the other hand, its energy is still quantized, and all kinds of things. Quantum mechanical are true about it, but it no longer has any evidence, any effects of superposition. No longer any interference effects. That's correct. Yeah.
You chose h equals zero here, but you could have chosen any h that commutes with rho. Is there anything special about those systems?
The equation that I'm deriving holds not just for some particular rho, but these equations hold for any density operator. And so I couldn't pick an h that would commute with any density operator unless it was the identity. Okay, and so that would definitely make things a little more complicated. But for example, suppose I had something that was that had a z component, like the energy separation of spin up and spin down in a magnetic field. What would happen? What would happen is these equations would be a little more complicated. They'd be coupled to each other, and the thing would not only decay toward the axis; it would also spin around. So instead of going straight in toward the axis, it would approach it in a spiral way. The spiraling would correspond to the precessing of the spin due to that term. So you get more complicated motion in the block spin. Yes?
During Nima's lectures in the beginning,
go ahead. I'm just trying to listen.
During Nima's lectures, we were talking about the performing of measurements. With using a large apparatus with, I guess, sort of looks like an environment in a way. So, and we said that there was a decoherence process then too, and the density operator evolved to something like that mixture in the end. So, So maybe we can think of this model as a cosmological model for that.
Sure. Yes, very, very much so. In the very simplest case, in a more complicated system, then this decoherence process, which seems to be very important in the emergence of classical measurement results from quantum interactions, and is related to an interaction with the environment, that may be a more complicated thing to do. But if you only want to look at how the system's own state changes, and the Markov approximation holds good, you'll be able to model it using some appropriate choice of the L operators. The L operators, of course, will depend on the interaction with the environment, the initial state of the environment, but you'll get something like this. Yeah. Yes.
So, L can assume that isn't just that every single, you know, like.
So L is unitary.
Yeah,
it could be.
Most of the coherence process exponential. So
I'm not sure I understood the question. You said if LK is unitary, then isn't, say it again?
Isn't like most of the decoherence exponential? Like it go from pure to extra.
How quickly that happens does depend on the strength of this. And so, for example, in an NMR system, I said it was a few seconds. That's forever. A few seconds is incredible. Because if you're in an NMR system with a pretty good magnetic field, the thing may be processing at a frequency of hundreds of megahertz. And so a decay over a period of a decay in coherences over a period of a few seconds is incredibly slow on the time scale of nuclei. So the fact that it happens fast depends on the time scale. It happens exponentially. But it does depend on what this is, and a few seconds, wow, that's like forever. Which is why all those NMR machines across the park at the Institute of Quantum Computing, because those guys maintain coherences between states for experimentally interesting periods of time. Okay, other questions? Clearly, I'm not going to finish everything I wanted to say today, but that's okay, because this is not my last chance to tell you things. I want to just address a particular question. We've got this... This nice model of how things go. The model basically is this: we've got a specific model. We've got an initially unentangled environment. We've got some state in Q, and they interact in a unitary way, and I get an evolution that I can describe in this way. How general is that model? How general could quantum evolution be? So let's just imagine that we had some evolution. Let's assume that rho evolves to rho prime, which is some function of rho. And I just want to know, just what properties would this function have to have? So this is supposed to describe some time evolution. And I'm assuming that there is a map. I'm assuming that there is a map that takes the initial state described by a density operator and gives me the final state described by a density operator. But I don't know what it is. What could it be? What are the necessary properties of E? That's my question. Okay. And so, in order to explore this, I want to give a picture of how to think about density matrices, or density operators rather. The ensemble picture. Okay? So I've got an ensemble. Okay, and in the ensemble, I have various states, okay, that occur. That is to say, each of these dots represents a system, an independent system. And this one's in row 1, and this one's in row 2, and this one's in row 1, and this one's in row 2, and this one's in row 1. Okay? Right? And so the overall state that that this ensemble represents, if I draw at random from this ensemble, the overall state that this ensemble represents is just some frequency, probability, P1 times row 1 plus P2 row 2. Okay? Now let's suppose that this evolution described by this function that I don't know anything about yet, that this evolution happens to each and every one of these systems. So this guy starts out in the state row 1. So what does he wind up over here as? E of row 1, right? E of row 1. And this guy's in the state E of row 2, and this guy's in the state E of row 1, and this guy's in the state E of row 2, and this guy's in the state E of row 1. Each system is independent in the ensemble. Okay? Now, how would I describe this? Well, I would describe this as a fraction P1 of them are in E row 1, and a fraction P2 of them are in E of row 2. Right? But that must be what I would get if I applied E to the overall average state row. That has to be what the overall average state for row is, because this ensemble represents row. This ensemble, if I just grab a state a system at random from the ensemble, I have to describe its density operator by row. So if I just grab a final state from this density operator from this ensemble, I have to have its density operator be E of row, because E takes initial density operators to final density operators. So E of row must be equal to this. And so that means first requirement is that E is a linear map, because E of the linear combination is the linear combination of the E's. E is a linear map on rows. It's a linear map on rows. In other words, it's a super operator. It's an element of the linear operators on linear operators. It must be. Okay, second requirement. Also, for any, I'll put it this way. Row is always a positive operator. And it must be the case that E row is also positive. I'm doing these out of order. Let me hold this comment in abeyance and say the easier thing first. Okay, the easier thing first. I know that the trace of rho, which is equal to 1, had better be equal to the trace of E of rho. Okay, the second thing is that E has to be a superoperator that preserves the trace. E is trace preserving. Okay, now, E has to be positive. That is to say, E has to be a superoperator that takes positive operators to positive operators, because the final state had better be a positive trace 1 operator, because it has to be a density operator. This had better be a density operator, a legal density operator, which means it has to have trace 1 and it has to be positive. And so, that leads us to condition 3, that E is a positive map. which means that it maps a positive operator. It maps positive operators to positive operators. Yeah.
So if you only need it to be trace preserving, then for a positive operator, mm-hmm. it'll map it to a positive operator.
No, because you can have a negative operator with a positive, not negative, an operator with a positive trace, with the trace one, that has eigenvalues 2, 3, and minus 4. Okay? And then it has negative eigenvalues. Right. So the trace is not sufficient to establish the positivity of the operator.
Does positive map mean that it could map a negative operator to a positive operator?
A positive map simply means that if you feed it a positive operator as input, you get a positive operator as output. It doesn't say anything about other things. I mean, a negative. What is a negative operator? It's actually a funny idea. You can talk about non-positive operators, because some operators have both positive and negative eigenvalues. You can talk about an operator that's the negative of a positive operator, and so on. So you can talk about operators being differences of positive operators or things like that. But positive simply means this. Okay, finally, that looks like it might be good, that looks like it might be sufficient, but it turns out it's not. It turns out, no, this is not sufficient. This is not enough. There needs to be one more requirement, or actually we need to improve requirement number 3. It turns out that you have to consider not just the evolution of this system, but the evolution of larger systems of which this system might be a subsystem. So let's imagine that we have A and B. We have A and B. And A evolves in time according to this operator. Okay? And what does B do? B does nothing. It just sits there. Whatever the initial state of B is, that's the final state. Okay? The identity. Okay, which I won't write as a 1, because this is the identity super operator. This is A goes to A and B goes to B. Okay, right. All right, and so if I have A, something that tells you how states on A evolve, that'll tell me that there's some evolution on AB where A evolves according to this and B does nothing. Okay? And I can call that E tensor I. Now, here's the point. This had also better be a positive operator, no matter what B is. This had also better be a positive super operator. If I start out with a state of AB, even an entangled state, I had better get a density operator for AB that makes sense, a legal density operator. Okay? So this says that not only, this requirement would be that not only is E itself a positive operator, but any extension of E in this way is also a positive operator, a positive super operator. Super E is a super operator, it's an operator on operators, a map. Not only is E a positive map, any extension of E is a positive map. And this condition is called, we'll call that 3+, E is completely positive. And that is to say, E tensor I is a positive map. It turns out that there are some positive maps that are not completely positive. It's kind of fun to play with those. So if you just considered the system itself, it looks like it might be a sensible evolution for the state. But if you imagine that system being embedded in a larger system, you can get crazy negative probabilities out. Okay? So 3 sort of supersedes, 3 plus sort of supersedes 3. And completely positive is often abbreviated CP. All right, so we've I think that The answer to the question, what properties must E have? A minimal answer to that question is 1 and 2 and 3 plus. Nothing else would make sense. If any of these fail, it will lead to nonsensical results. But there's a wonderful theorem. This is a wonderful theorem, okay? Truly wonderful theorem. And the wonderful theorem has two parts. And of course, it has two conclusions, but it has one hypothesis. We're going to suppose, this is actually the representation theorem for CP maps, or for trace preserving CP maps. But it's really the wonderful theorem. Suppose E satisfies our three minimal requirements, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus. That is to say, it is a trace preserving, completely positive linear map on operators. Okay? Then, there exist AK operators such that the sum over K of AK dagger AK equals the identity, and E of rho is the operator sum over K AK rho AK dagger. It's true. If these properties, which are the minimal reasonableness properties that we might come up with, if that's true, then there is a representation. I can write down that map in this form with some Krauss operators. There's a Krauss representation. Point two, and let me write point two even over here. Because I don't want to put it down so low that you can't read it. Second conclusion. We can construct an imagined external system with an imagined initial state and an imagined unitary operation. This is a story that we're telling. Okay, we're making these up. We might believe that there's something like this, but we're making these up. But we can make up such things such that E of rho is just equal to the trace over the system E of U, rho tensor projection onto that U dagger. In other words, if our map on density operators satisfies our reasonableness criteria, then we can always imagine that that evolution corresponds to unitary evolution on a larger system, including an environment that we then trace over. This is the unitary representation of the CP map. What that means is that our model for open system dynamics is pretty much general. Because if there's some kind of open system dynamics represented by a map on density operators, an initial density operator turns into a final density operator, if there is such a map, that map pretty much has to satisfy these criteria. And if it satisfies these criteria, I can think of it as unitary evolution on a larger system, and I can find a representation in terms of Krauss operators. Isn't that wonderful? Yes?
Is this a constructor?
Yes. So what I basically do to prove this is I imagine a particular entangled state fed into this that will give me a particular density operator from this, and from the properties of that density operator, I can prove everything else. Quite constructive. And I can. It's the last appendix in the QSI book, and you can read the whole all the gory details. And a little too much pedantic detail of how this theorem is proved. And so our description is good enough for any open system dynamics that makes sense. Questions? Yeah?
Are those two first things equivalent to saying that E has to preserve the convex structure of the set of states?
Preserve the what structure? The
convex structure.
Convex structure. Actually, the first one by itself preserves the convex structure. But the next guys say that your image of your convex set of states lies inside the convex set of states.
But if it's linear, can I say that the pure state is
Oh no, that doesn't follow. It doesn't. It preserves the convexity of the set. But as we saw, we could take the whole blocks here, where the pure states are on the outside, and map them to a subset of the block ball that doesn't contain most of the pure states. That's perfectly possible. But nevertheless, the convexity relations are preserved by that. Yeah.
What does convex structure of the states mean?
Okay, convex structure. When you talk about a linear combination of things, where the coefficients of the linear combination are like probabilities, they are non-negative numbers that add up to one. So then that's called a convex combination of it. And in a vector space, the convex combination of two vectors is a vector that lies in the line between them. The convex combination of three vectors is inside the triangle that these guys are the endpoints of. And in general, the concept of convex combination says that you can't kind of get outside of the region that's mapped out by the boundary points. So the convex structure of quantum states is that any convex combination of density operators is a mixture and is also a quantum state, a mixed quantum state. That's what that means. Is that helpful? Yeah. Yeah. I haven't said this, you can, since you're just making up the environment, it turns out that if the dimension of the Hilbert space for original state has a dimension D, you can make up a model like this where the environment has a dimension no bigger than d squared. So, but the real environment might have a bigger dimension. But really, it doesn't have to be arbitrarily large. And you only have to have up to d squared cross operators. So there's a limit to how many you need. Okay, I'm way over. And Neil, in some sense, the boss of my boss. Might get mad at me, so we're going to have to cut this off and we'll regather on Monday.